What do you think about when you think about Antarctica? Cold? Penguins? How about motherhood, collaboration, the future of human life? With an unexpected perspective, author Elizabeth Rush joined an expedition to an unexplored part of the Southern Continent, and she reports her experience in The Quickening, Creation and Community at the Ends of the Earth. Elizabeth teaches literary nonfiction at Brown University, and her essays have appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, Granta, Guernica, and other publications. Her latest book has received rapturous reviews, and here she is to share five of its key insights.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Rush, the author of The Quickening, Creation and Community at the Ends of the Earth. The Quickening's a book about two seemingly disconnected stories. One tells the tale of a 54-day scientific expedition on board a government-run icebreaker to the calving edge of the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica, which I was lucky enough to be invited to be a part of in 2019. Listeners at home may know Thwaites by its terrifying nickname, the Doomsday Glacier. That's because Thwaites alone contains over 2 feet of potential sea level rise, and were it to wholly disintegrate, it could destabilize the entire West Antarctic ice sheet, causing global sea levels to jump 10 feet or more. So that's one theme of the book. The other theme in the book investigates the choice to have a child as the climate crisis accelerates. The Quickening is a different kind of Antarctic adventure tale, preoccupied not with flag planting, but with the collective and challenging work of imagining a better future. So today I thought I'd share with you five surprising insights that I learned while working on this book and traveling literally to the very ends of the earth and back. My first insight would come early on in the research process. As soon as I learned that I would deploy to Antarctica on an icebreaker, I went to the library to see what had been written by people who'd traveled to Antarctica before me. Like, if you're a nonfiction writer, that's just what you do. And I was floored, absolutely floored, to learn that the first person to see the last continent did so in 1820, just over 200 years ago, which means that every single personal account of Antarctica has been penned in the last two centuries. So I dove into these texts and very quickly became bored because they, like the overwhelming majority of them, mention the same half a dozen events. Amundsen's conquest of the pole, Scott's death 11 miles from One Ton Depot, Shackleton's miraculous return, Douglas Mawson shooting and eating his sled dogs. I'm sure listeners at home are familiar with these stories. These few stories are woven into every account of the last continent's history. They're the origin stories that circulate through the only place on Earth that has no original inhabitants, the tales that get told and retold by each successive generation. And they really build up a set of expectations, not just about what Antarctic narratives include and what they don't, but who belongs on the ice in the first place. So the more I read, the more I realized that I wanted very little to do with this tradition. At the time, I was also thinking about having a child, and so motherhood and life-making was very much on my mind. What if I write a book about Antarctica and motherhood, I thought. It was there from the very beginning, and for me, it turned out that writing about these two impulses at the same time meant staring into the gaping maw of our changing planet and asking, how do I live with this desire? How do I hold these two seemingly opposite impulses in my mind and body and heart at the same time, one grounded in creation and the other in wanting to witness our disassembling planet up close? I really don't think there's an answer to that question. I think it's a question that each person has to encounter and live for themselves, and hopefully The Quickening gives readers an opportunity to encounter that question. Insight number two. It's more of a scientific insight, but one that illustrates how very limited our current understanding of Antarctica's past, present, and future behavior is. So if Antarctica is going to lose a lot of ice this century, it will likely come from Thwaites, and that's because this glacier rests below sea level. Its underside is exposed to warm water incursions that are causing rapid melting from beneath. Thwaites alone contains over 2 feet of potential sea level rise, and were it to wholly disintegrate, it could destabilize the entire West Antarctic ice sheet, causing global sea levels to jump 10 feet or more. In terms of the fate of our coastal communities, this glacier is the biggest wild card, the largest known unknown, the pile of coins that could tip the scales one way or another. Will Miami even exist in 100 years? The waits will decide. At least that's what many scientists think, which is how it got that crazy nickname, the Doomsday Glacier, a couple years back. But before our mission, no one had ever been to Thwaites Calving Edge, the place where the glacier discharges ice into the sea. So many of our ideas about how it will behave are a mixture of science and speculation, out-of-date modeling married to our increasing fear. The more we learn about Thwaites, the more profoundly we understand that many of our predictions about the speed of sea level rise are actually extremely tenuous. Based primarily on physical processes that human beings have already observed. Though it's possible that at the cold nadir of the planet, in a place that no one has before visited, let alone cataloged in the methodical way that science demands, one of the world's largest glaciers is stepping outside of the script we imagined for it, defying even our most detailed projections of what is to come. So this brings me to insight number three. The third insight hopefully begins to marry in a pretty overt way some of the book's two driving concerns, motherhood and Antarctica. It seems to me like people of my generation and younger are being faced with an impossible question. Is it still okay to have a child? Vermont is underwater. Is it still okay to have a child? It's 120 degrees in Phoenix. Is it still okay to have a child? Canada is on fire, and I'm breathing the unhealthy particulate matter here in Rhode Island today. Is it still okay to have a child? What will be my child's impact on our already unstable planet, and what will the planet's impact be on that child? So much of what lies ahead depends on how we humans act in the next 2 days, and yet, many of us still have to make this choice today because our reproductive clocks are ticking today. So this book is about sitting in that uncomfortable space, asking, how do I move forward? It's not a book that tells others how to act, but instead it's sort of about dwelling inside of this impossible era. And as I tried dwelling inside of this space, I found myself diving really deep into the history of population control and environmental stewardship. Want to save the planet? Bumper stickers ask, don't have kids. It's an argument whose long roots can be traced from the present-day interest in population control back through the movement for voluntary human extinction to biologist Paul Ehrlich's 1968 book, The Population Bomb. And, of course, to the work of the 19th century economist Thomas Malthus, who argued that famine and war occur when population growth outpaces agricultural production. So the fundamental premise is pretty clear. The Earth would be better off without us, or at the very least with fewer of us. But often this logic has been used only in select cases to restrict poor people of color's right to regenerate, while maintaining the rights of white women like myself, which is one of the big reasons why population control as an environmental measure doesn't really sit well with me. The second reason is also something that I would discover as I researched, primarily that fossil fuel companies purposefully popularized the use of the carbon footprint calculator, and in particular BP, in 2005. So these seemingly benign devices that calculate how much negative impact an individual's consumer choices, Prius or Jetta, meat or tofu, what they're doing at a psychological level is shifting blame for the climate crisis away from corporate polluters onto individuals who literally cannot, through their individual consumer actions alone, change the system they live within. Kids are often a line item in these calculation exercises, which to my mind is a huge categorical error. Choosing to become a parent is not the same as choosing Beyond B for a Chevy Bolt. And here I also want to draw folks' attention to the fact that, for instance, something that's never included in these carbon footprint calculators is that organized public protest could shut down a coal power plant for a single day, which would also keep 60 tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere. That's the amount that's the most widely referenced study suggests will be sequestered if someone in the developed world has one less kid. So I have, you know, qualms with population control as environmental action at multiple levels. And last but not least, the National Academy of Sciences suggests that even if we quickly shift to a worldwide one-child policy, we'll still have 5 to 10 billion people living on the planet in 2100. So the rapid transition away from fossil fuels over the next two decades, not fewer pregnancies, this is what's needed. Which brings me, I think, pretty seamlessly into insight number 4, which is collaboration is key to beginning to address climate change. And I'd like to talk about this insight with a little bit of an anecdote from my time on this icebreaker. So once we finally arrived at the weights, we had a little over a month to gather as much data as humanly possible about this place that no human had ever before visited. And it was literally like a switch flipped the day we arrived. There was no more of the keeping busy activities that saw us through the beginning of our journey. There was no more sauna club or bridge lessons, no more ping pong down in the hold or king cake at midnight. All that matters was data once we got to Thwaites. Mud samples, seafloor depths, temperature reading, wave actions. We even kept a real-time log of sea ice observations. Hypothetically, each of the scientific teams on board sliced their day in two. Some folks were supposed to work from noon to midnight and others from midnight to noon, but most would rest only when skating dangerously close to delirium. And moreover, scientists were assigned to specific teams tasked with getting specific data. But the sediment team regularly helped members of the SEAL team and vice versa. The whole undertaking was far more collaborative than I ever imagined. Heck, they even had me, the writer on board, helping them, you know, sample mud and dig for ancient penguin bones on isolated island chains. The whole undertaking was just really collaborative, and it made me appreciate scenes in Oppenheimer where it really illustrated that scientific breakthroughs are the result of teamwork, though I do think the movie was probably, of course, still over-invested in the personality of Oppenheimer. What we often think of as a solitary pursuit, the production of scientific knowledge, is really more like an extended relay race in which the baton just gets handed off again and again and again. The arc of any breakthrough is long and relies upon extraordinary human effort, including that in service of the most ordinary things. My final insight, and this is one that that I feel like has taken me a long time to arrive at, is that despair in the face of climate change is easy compared to action, to committing to building the future that you'd like. So everywhere I turn these days, I read about the new normal, the killing heat, the devastating floods, the toxic smoke, the emerald ash borer and the end of our ash trees, the woody adelgid and the end of our hemlock, all normal. That word is cloying and deceptive, and it steals from us the possibility of being transformed, and not just for the worst. What I've learned is that it's far too easy to accept the Thwaites' untimely end as inevitable, and to become immobilized by a kind of anticipatory despair. What's more difficult and more necessary is to continue to labor alongside the Thwaites, to try to investigate it, and our relationship with the more than human world with attention and care, to try to do the difficult work of building a better future together today, now. So thanks so much for listening to my podcast, and thanks so much for reading The Quickening, or I hope you read The Quickening. I hope this whet your appetite for this book, and also for becoming a little more active on climate at home in your day-to-day life. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That was Elizabeth Rush with 5 big ideas from The Quickening, Creation and Community at the Ends of the Earth. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.